everyone, and welcome back to Holistic Health Masterclass Podcast with me, your host, Brett Hawes. And hope you enjoyed last week's episode, a very inspirational, positive, and upbeat episode with my good friend Anna. And we are going to shift gears this week and really dive into quite a complex, hot-button health issue that is somewhat mysterious in a way, and there's not a lot of good research. I don't want to say it's taboo, because that's really the wrong word, but it's oftentimes sort of sloughed off as not a real condition. Of course, doctors are now starting to wake up to this, and people are starting to wake up to this and take it a bit more seriously. But what I'm talking about is Lyme disease. And if you know anything about Lyme disease, you will know that it is, you know, if you have all the classic signs and symptoms, pretty easy to diagnose, but you'll know that it's often misdiagnosed and sort of masquerades as other chronic illnesses. My guest today is Dr. Darren Ingles, and Darren is an accomplished doctor, practitioner, who has a private practice in Connecticut. He is the author of a book called The Lyme Solution, which is a five-part plan to actually heal yourself from Lyme disease. And I got to say, he has a remarkable story as a young guy who finished med school in Seattle and then came back to the Northeast and contracted Lyme disease and really went through a three-year journey of healing himself with natural medicine and has taken that lesson and transformed it into the work that he does today, which is really focusing on helping thousands and thousands of patients to date overcome their Lyme disease. So we're going to be discussing his five-part solution. We actually dive into all of that. We talk about the limitations of testing on this episode. We talk about misdiagnoses and undiagnosed Lyme and some of the illnesses that it masquerades as. So, you know, this episode is pretty dense, I got to tell you. It's chock full of very useful information. And I would encourage you to stick to the end, because we do talk about a convention that's coming up. Obviously, if you're listening to this months in the future, this would have already passed. But check out the show notes. And there's a link if you are a practitioner who's looking to really dive into Lyme disease. Dr. Ingles is putting on a conference coming up this summer, 2018, where he will be gathering Lyme experts from around North America to really teach practitioners how to properly diagnose, address, and so on, Lyme disease in their practice. So really awesome episode. Nice to finally have some solutions with Lyme, because we've really heard so much about how terrible it is and et cetera, et cetera. But now we actually have some real solutions that have been tried and tested on thousands of patients. If you do like this episode, please consider sharing, subscribing. And of course, as always, if you have any questions, please hit us up on Facebook. You will actually see on that note that I have recently merged the Holistic Health Masterclass Facebook page with my own page. So the Facebook page now, which has been consolidated, is Holistic Health Masterclass - Brett Hawes. And that's really where everything will be streaming from now on. And of course, you can also go to straight to the website, which is www.holistichealthmasterclass.com, and check us out there as well. So yeah, that's it. Enjoy today's episode and welcome Dr. Darren Ingles. Welcome to the show, Darren. Thanks for being here.
Oh, thanks for having me, Brett.
So, Darren, you have your new book that has literally just hit the shelves, all about Lyme disease, five-part solution. But we will definitely work our way and probably spend most of our time on the book, because, you know, the response that I've seen out there has been amazing. This is actually, I think, the first book that I've really seen that's very practical for, you know, person in the street kind of thing. But before we get there, you know, you yourself, you know, have the sort of what I call the classics, the classic hero's journey, if you will. And you yourself actually had Lyme disease, and that's sort of how you find yourself in the line of work that you do. Is that correct? Or
Well, yeah, ironically, I started out as a microbiologist before I was a doctor and actually used to do Lyme disease testing in the laboratory. And then many years later, I ended up going back to medical school. But when I moved to Connecticut and about 3 weeks before I opened my own practice, I got infected with Lyme disease. And I had, classic Lyme, everything you read in a medical textbook, I pretty much had all the symptoms, the headache and the joint pain and the 105 degree fever and a big bullseye rash right on the back of my leg that initially I didn't see at all. So, I got to go through everything that most patients go through, and I went on doxycycline. And after 4 days of treatment, I actually felt quite well. But since I had just opened my own business, I was the doctor, the bookkeeper, the receptionist, and doing everything and working very long hours. And after about 8 months of keeping up that schedule, I started to relapse and get symptoms again. So I went back on antibiotics and it didn't do anything. And I changed antibiotics and it didn't do anything. And really, over the course of the next 8 or 9 months, I kept changing antibiotic protocols, but was actually getting worse and worse. I lost, I think, about 25 pounds, and my gut was a wreck, and I really just felt terrible. So I was fortunate to have had a few patients who had seen a doctor in New York City who was treating him with Chinese herbs and acupuncture. So I went to see him, and he really kind of pulled me out of the weeds. And, I think it was really kind of a wake-up call for me to come back to my naturopathic roots and really examine, what was I doing to myself that was kind of keeping me from getting well. And it was really about taking stock of, my sleep pattern and what I was eating, and really trying to make those kind of changes to start that healing process. So it was really a combination of, herbal therapies and homeopathy and dealing with some of the lifestyle issues. And it, took me about 3 years in total, but, eventually got to a point where I got my life back.
Yeah. And that's, I mean, amazing, because I know that there are so many people out there who suffer and have no resolve at all. They never ever get to that point of fully resolving their case. But you touched on a couple of things that I think are worth discussing. You mentioned having all the classic signs and symptoms and so on, and the bullseye rash. But did you actually know at that time that you had Lyme disease, or were you properly diagnosed? Because I know this is a common thing, right? I mean, people have these signs and symptoms and it gets diagnosed as whatever else, and they don't get the proper treatment.
Yeah, well, it was kind of funny because I actually had meningitis when I was in college. And when I started getting all these symptoms, I thought I had meningitis again because it really felt like the same. And as I was actually on my way to the hospital, someone else had noticed that I had a big bullseye rash on the back of my leg. Well, it was on the back of my leg. I couldn't see it. I didn't know it was there. So I pulled out the double mirror thing and saw it. And I said, okay, well, now I know what it is. When you see that bullseye rash, that really is very classic for Lyme. There's no other infectious agent that we know of that causes that kind of rash. So once I saw the rash, I put two and two together and figured out it was Lyme.
And so how long was it in between seeing the rash and experiencing those symptoms? I mean, are we talking a matter of a couple of days or a couple of weeks or what?
Yeah, I probably had symptoms for about 3 or 4 days, maybe even longer, maybe it was 5 days before I got sick enough that I'm like, okay, initially I just kind of felt flu-like. And again, I'd been working hard and was kind of run down. So I figured, it's just a virus running through me. But then I started to get the numbness and the tingling, and I'm thinking, boy, that's not very typical for a viral infection to get neuropathy. And then once I spiked the 105 fever, I said, okay, there's definitely something going on here that's more than just the run-of-the-mill virus. And I was ready to go to the hospital and was fortunate to have caught that bullseye rash. And at that point, I just went to a walk-in clinic. I told them I had Lyme disease, and they kind of laughed at me and said, well, how do you know? And I pointed at my leg. I'm like, well, because there's nothing else that causes this kind of rash. And they said, oh, yeah, you have Lyme disease. So it was a pretty straightforward case of Lyme. And again, I think it's actually kind of unique because most of the patients I work with don't have that experience. They don't find it early. And more often than not, they go months to years of being symptomatic and really have no clue why they're sick.
I mean, that's exactly it, right? So I guess the next question is, and you sort of touched on this. So you went straight on to doxycycline, you did antibiotics, and it worked, quote unquote. We'll come back to that in a minute. Now, I know that there's some sort of incubation period or window where if you don't catch it in time, you know, the infection sort of now moves from being acute to being chronic, and that comes with its own set of problems, right? And I might be correct, or sorry, incorrect in saying that, but at that point then, this is where misdiagnoses happen and antibiotics don't really work anymore. Is that correct, or?
Yeah, I think so. And I sort of equate Lyme similar to autism in some way, that it's a spectral disorder and there's no one single presentation of Lyme disease. Again, there are some people like me who got textbook Lyme. More often than not, we see very vague, nebulous symptoms that can look like, you know, 100 other different conditions. And I think that's where people fall through the cracks, is that they have this constellation of symptoms that aren't really well explained. And they've been to, you know, 5, 6, 7 doctors who've done tons of tests, and everything comes back negative. And really, even depending on where you live, I mean, I think if you live up here in the Northeast where Lyme is endemic, you know, Lyme disease is on doctors' minds. But if you live in Florida, if you live in Texas, places where they don't really think about Lyme disease much, it's even easier to fall through the cracks.
Yeah, even where we are in Canada, I mean, it's only in the last couple of years that people have really been talking about it, and conventional medicine has actually been paying attention to that and testing for it.
Yeah, you know, I gave a talk up in Toronto back in February, and I was doing some research on Canadian statistics, and I was really surprised that the number of cases in Canada in total, I think it was either 2015 or 2016, was less than 1,000 cases that were reported. And that was really shocking to me, because, you know, one of the hot spots in the United States is the central Midwest, which is, you know, Minnesota, Wisconsin, which borders Ontario. So yeah. I don't think there's any magical barrier between the United States and Canada that stops ticks from, you know, migrating from one country to another.
Yeah, so, they're not checking passports at the border, right?
I don't think so. So yeah, I was really surprised that that there weren't more cases reported. So my speculation is that there's probably a lot more Lyme there than is known, and it may really just be an issue that doctors just aren't really looking for it.
Yeah, and that's exactly it. I mean, and, you know, have you seen in your practice, because I know that Lyme definitely mimics other diseases. Are there some common illnesses or diseases or conditions or whatever that Lyme might mimic, or is it sort of all over the map?
Well, there's many of them. I mean, off the top of my head, I think the ones that probably come up most often is, you know, chronic fatigue syndrome, fibromyalgia. Multiple sclerosis is a very common one in my practice. Pretty much everyone I see who's been diagnosed with MS has Lyme, and when you treat their Lyme, their MS gets better. Other neurological conditions like Parkinson's, Alzheimer's. I work with a lot of children with autism. A lot of children with autism also have Lyme. You know, there's upwards of, you know, 80 different conditions that have been associated with Lyme disease. So I think, wow, you know, when people get these diagnoses that are kind of vague, you know, chronic fatigue, yeah. Yeah. What's that? You know, it's just it's a series of symptoms. And I certainly don't believe that Lyme is the cause of all of it, but it certainly can be a cause for some of it, you know, particularly again for people who live in these Lyme endemic areas.
Yeah. So in your practice, I know that there's different diagnostic methods for Lyme, and I know that some of it can be a little bit tricky. Could you perhaps elaborate on, you know, what type of testing one would actually do to get a concrete Lyme diagnosis?
Well, unfortunately, even with the best of testing, you know, none of it is great. Mm-hmm. The worst of the worst really is the test that most people get. And if you go to any regular reference lab, the test kit they use, it's really the same test kit we've been using for 40 years. And it's kind of surprising given that, you know, we've got 40 years of research behind Lyme disease, and we really haven't changed a whole lot in the way we think about Lyme. You know, this test that's out there was really never designed to be diagnostic. It was really intended to monitor people that had known Lyme disease. And even if you go to the Center for Disease Control's website in the United States, it even tells you that Lyme is a clinical diagnosis. It really is based on symptoms. You know, the piece of paper is great if it helps confirm our suspicion, but at the end of the day, you know, we look at the symptoms you have, we do the blood test, and we also need to rule out other possibilities. You know, because Lyme disease does look like a lot of other conditions, you know, you can do other types of tests to rule out whether it's Epstein-Barr or some other kind of autoimmune disease. And, you know, once you've ruled all that out and, you know, you've got this, again, constellation of symptoms, you know, the blood test, you know, again, may give you extra information about whether someone's had exposure. But for example, you know, the test that's out there right now through most reference labs, you know, a good lab test will be about 95% sensitive, which means that if you actually have the disease, it'll pick it up 95% of the time. What we know about the current Lyme test is it's only about 43% sensitive. So really, wow, it doesn't even pick up half the people who actually have Lyme disease. And because it's an antibody test, it's still dependent on all the factors that, you know, generate an antibody response. Yep. So if there's kind of immune deficiency or other defect in your immune system that doesn't make antibodies, then an antibody test, you know, isn't very helpful. You know, in most bacteria, you know, we love to be able to culture it. You know, we can culture it from a sinus infection, a throat infection, and grow it out on a plate and find out exactly what it is. But in the case of Lyme, you know, we can't really easily culture it. So we can't measure it directly in the body. And therefore, we really do kind of rely on these antibody tests. But again, a positive antibody test at its most basic level is really just telling us that someone has had exposure to the organism.
And so you might not even have an active infection, right? You might have something that's laying dormant. Is that correct?
Sure. And we know from the research that, you know, even if someone gets bit by a tick, well, A, it's possible that your immune system could react right away and you never get to the point where it even becomes symptomatic. But you'll show antibodies on that test because you have been exposed. Alternatively, right, you know, it can actually take a while for that antibody response to happen. So if you know you got bit, you know, 2 days ago and you do an antibody test today, well, it may take a week or longer, up to 30 days, for your body even to make antibodies. So again, your test would look negative. And again, that doesn't rule out the possibility that you have Lyme. So, yeah, you know, it's a bit complicated and a bit controversial. And fortunately, there are other labs out there, certainly here in the United States, that offer, I think, better testing methods. And often we will pick up Lyme on those tests when they're not picked up on the standard test that most reference labs use.
Yeah, and I do know of some of those. I think just for time's sake and for complexity's sake, we won't go there today because it does get a little convoluted. But regardless, it is good to know that there are some tests that are more sensitive, if you will. And of course, those are only available in the U.S. as far as I know.
Right. Well, and just as a kind of a brief rundown for the folks who are up in Canada, you know, iGenX, which is based out of Palo Alto, California, is a great lab, and they operate in Canada. And then there's a new lab that opened last year called Global Lyme Diagnostics. And what I like about them is that not only do they test for Borrelia burgdorferi, which is the one strain that we tend to associate mostly with Lyme, they actually have a test now that tests for all the different strains of Borrelia. So again, I've run that test in parallel with some of the other tests, and even when the other tests are negative, this one's positive. And Global Lyme also operates in Canada. So for anyone up in Canada, both of these labs are available.
Okay, great. That's really, really good to know. So thank you. Thanks for sharing that. A couple of things that I want to circle back to. There's a lot of, I guess, misperception or misunderstanding about You get bitten by a tick, you have an acute reaction, and then there's this incubation period, if you will, where time moves forward, and then all of a sudden you have a chronic infection that's extremely difficult to treat. Do you know, first of all, is that correct? And second of all, what's the sort of window that people are looking at where, you know, okay, after 30 days, it's going to be really hard to treat, or after 2 weeks, or after 6 months? What does that look like?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. I think, you know, the CDC takes a very conservative perspective and says that, you know, most people after they get bit by a tick will probably experience symptoms within a week of that bite. However, I have seen patients in my practice that have Lyme disease, and as we can tell based on their history, they may have been exposed many years ago. So yeah, I think it's possible that you could get bit. And at the time, you know, if your immune system's working well, that organism's there, but it never gets to the point where it actually causes any kind of symptoms. But, you know, somewhere down the line, if your immune system starts to tank for any reason, you know, that organism that's been kind of kept at bay is now allowed to move forward and starts creating symptoms. You know, I think the way that I equate it is that, you know, you can get chicken pox when you're 5 years old, and you can get shingles when you're 55 years old. And it's the same virus that's been in your body for 50 years. So we certainly know that there's microbes that can stay dormant in your body and, you know, really become opportunistic and come out only when your immune system's under duress. And I think that's certainly possible with Lyme as well. You know, even though Lyme is technically a bacteria, in many ways, it behaves more like a virus. And it does have the ability to penetrate cells where most bacteria can't do that. So, yeah, I think, you know, the answer to that question is that there are probably some people that get infected initially, do not display symptoms right away, and those symptoms don't really manifest until months to years after the fact.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And something else that you keep sort of touching on here is this immune response. And I did read somewhere, either your book or website or somewhere along the line, that do you actually consider Lyme disease an autoimmune disease, or do you just feel like it triggers a lot of autoimmune disease?
Well, you know, again, we've got a lot of evidence in the literature that not just Lyme, but a lot of microbes can become catalysts for autoimmunity.
Yeah.
It's different that it's not autoimmunity necessarily in the way that we think of, you know, lupus and rheumatoid arthritis, because many of those markers, when you do the blood tests, come back completely normal. But again, we do find, you know, Lyme, for example, we know that there's at least three different proteins on the brain that get targeted with Lyme. So it through this mechanism, what we call molecular mimicry, you know, there's a molecule on the organism that looks like a molecule on our own tissue. So as the immune system gets activated, it accidentally starts affecting our brain, our joints, our muscles, and so forth. So I think a lot of these systemic symptoms that we see in many respects can be due to this autoimmune reaction. So I think once people kind of phase out of that acute infection, and where we end up with this chronic Lyme disease, or what they now call kind of post-Lyme syndrome, is really this manifestation of this autoimmune reaction that's occurred. So if you keep treating Lyme purely as an infection, I don't think you get very far. And my experience is such that people who only do antibiotics and really do nothing else, they tend to get fairly limited improvement. And, you know, as soon as they come off the antibiotics, they're kind of back to square one. So it really is about building the terrain, building the gut, building the immune system, doing all these other things to the body to help really kind of overcome this autoimmune problem.
Yeah, because, I mean, obviously from my own experience and my own practice, you know, people that come and see you with chronic issues like this, especially longstanding autoimmune disease, you know that that's been wear and tear for 10, 15, 20, 30, 40 years. And so clearly, you know, that takes a toll on the guts, the immune system's out of whack, and so on and so on. So I think that, you know, really what we're both saying here is we're talking about a holistic approach to really clearing this up. And it's interesting because, you know, a lot of people are still under that assumption that even if you have chronic Lyme, like you should still just take the antibiotics and hope that they work. And I guess what I'm hearing from you is that that's only a very, very small piece of the puzzle. So I guess on that note, I mean, let's hop right into it, because your book actually has a 5-part plan, and perhaps you can walk us through what that 5-part plan really looks like, and then we can sort of dive into some of the sections of that.
Sure. Well, the first part of it really is about gut health. And what we know is that 80% or so of your immune function comes from the gut. So if your gut's not functioning well, it's really hard for your immune system to function well. So we're looking at, you know, how well you're digesting and absorbing your food. Do you have chronic constipation, diarrhea, gas, bloating, you know, heartburn, reflux? You know, all of these can be signs that the intestinal tract isn't really doing what you want. And if you're getting any element of inflammation in the gut, the trickle-down effect is that it may actually impact how well your immune system functions. So, you know, I talk a lot about, you know, various nutritional therapies that you can utilize to help heal the gut, repopulate the gut, particularly for people who've been on long-term antibiotics and have probably wiped out a fair amount of their normal flora. You can help repopulate that with, you know, various high-quality probiotics. And so it really is about, you know, how do we repair the gut, restore gut health, and optimize its function?
Yeah. Have you noticed in your practice that a lot of people with Lyme have things like leaky gut?
Most of them.
Really? Interesting.
Not all of them. I think, again, when we go back in their history, even before they got infected, we often hear a history of some sort of gastrointestinal problem. So, again, I think the stage was already kind of set. And then once they got infected, it just kind of, you know, toppled the tower. And that's when they started experiencing a lot of the symptoms.
All right. So step one, nutritional support and everything else to do with gut health. And step two?
And step two is really about diet. So, you know, having tried a lot of different diets myself, from, you know, paleo to keto to autoimmune and so forth, what I really kind of settled on and what I found seems to work best for most of my patients is what's called an alkaline diet. And what an alkaline diet really represents is, you know, eating foods that help promote better cellular alkalinity. So we certainly don't change blood pH with this. No, blood pH is very tightly regulated. It's not going to change at all. But it really is about, you know, changing what's happening at a cellular level. And we know just from basic physiology that, you know, your stomach, your bladder, and for women, the vaginal area is very acidic. And that's really to help protect against outside invaders. But the rest of your body actually functions best in an alkaline state. So that means all the inner workings of the cells and the enzymes and, you know, DNA replication, you know, all of these processes really work best in an alkaline state. And, you know, the way I always equate it, you know, you've always heard probably the last 30 years about acid rain and what acid rain does to the soil and how it destroys it, depletes it. Well, it's kind of a similar process for our own bodies as we keep dumping more acids into it that ultimately leads to more inflammation. So at the end of the day, what this diet is really about is a way of controlling inflammation.
And so, go ahead.
Well, it really, in a nutshell, as you know, an alkaline diet is mostly a vegetarian diet where we limit animal protein, so that's meat, fish, eggs, shellfish, to less than 20% of your total dietary intake. And then we really eliminate any junk foods, processed foods, dairy products, coffee, you know, any of these highly acid-forming foods we try to get out of the diet. And again, I find that this is a diet that, you know, most people can follow. It's not so restrictive that you can't enjoy food at all. But clinically, you know, I get good results from it.
And it's interesting. And, you know, I'm sort of going to blow things open a little bit, but there's a lot of people nowadays, generally speaking, I mean, paleo diets and ketogenic have just become huge, right? And a couple of things that I've been hearing, perhaps you know more about this, a couple of things I've been hearing is how high-fat diets can really be bad news for chronic infections and dragging infections across the gut barrier and so on. Do you know anything about that? Have you come across that at all?
You know, not specifically with keto. You know, my issue with keto is I think it's a really great induction kind of diet. Again, I think if you start looking at the long-term effects of the keto diet, first and foremost, it's very difficult for people. Yeah. You know, I try to be very realistic about, you know, again, if it's something I can't do, I certainly don't expect other people to do it. I've tried keto. I find it terribly difficult to follow. And I'm, you know, pretty knowledgeable about nutrition and what I can and cannot eat. So there's just the practicality that it's a very difficult diet for people to follow. But aside from that, you know, again, I think if we start looking at potential long-term nutritional consequences, I do have concerns about it. I don't necessarily agree that it is a good long-term diet, where, you know, a paleo diet is really tends for a lot of people, at least in the United States, it tends to be a very high animal protein diet.
Yeah.
They feel like if they're going to be paleo, they just have to be complete meat eaters. And their meat intake or their animal protein intake goes up to sometimes double what they probably should get. And that high amount of protein, you know, can actually be very taxing to your kidneys. So I'm not sure, again, that that's a necessarily good long-term plan. But if you look at an alkaline diet at its most fundamental level, I think it actually is the closest thing to what our paleo forefathers probably actually ate. You know, we didn't kill every day. So, yeah. You know, it wasn't like we were eating meat all the time. I mean, it was available whenever you could get it, but I don't think that was a daily thing. So, you know, when we're talking about limited animal protein, again, I think that's probably a little bit closer to what the caveman was actually eating.
Yeah, well, what's interesting on that, I know we're getting sidetracked a little bit, but it's a worthwhile discussion because I know a lot of people are talking about this. When you actually look at the Hadza tribe from East Africa and the Lost Tribe of the Amazon, they've now done, you know, extensive studies on them and analyses of their diet and everything else. And what's interesting is you find that the diet is actually 70% carbohydrate.
Yeah.
You know, so a lot of times when we think of hunter-gatherer, everyone loves to focus on the hunter. And, and it's like, well, you didn't just have a cow standing in a field and, you know, hey, does everyone want to eat? We'll go over and just club it and let's eat. You know, so you had to track animals sometimes for 2 weeks. Right. And then people would eat like tons of meat and then that would be it for another two or 3 weeks.
Right.
And that would also change with the seasons and so on and so on. So I think in many ways you're correct. And also I would add to that we are also talking about something that is both therapeutic and also long-term is actually sustainable.
Well, exactly. You know, and I've tried various diets on myself and with a lot of patients, and you know, I also wanted something that is doable. And this is a doable, sustainable lifestyle kind of thing that anybody can change. Look, you know, I love coffee. And, you know, when I was in the midst of Lyme, I would find even a sip of coffee would exacerbate my symptoms. So the concept even of, well, I just have a little, it's not so much. You know, it really depends on your sensitivity level. And for some people, even that little bit can be enough to aggravate symptoms. So I do, you know, tell people when they first start making these dietary changes to really try and be diligent and stick to the program, because you're going to give yourself the best results. And as you, your health improves, you know, you probably got a little bit more flexibility and, you know, cheating every now and then. But this really ultimately does become a lifestyle change that you'll probably carry with you your whole life.
Mm-hmm. No, spot on. You know, and I think we're both approaching that. I know many of the practitioners, you know, who might be listening to this as well, that is a common way of getting people on the right track. And it's just a good overall healthy diet. So perfect. Part three in your 5-part plan.
So part three is really about dealing with the infection. And so I talk about several different herbal protocols that I personally use to treat my Lyme. Again, I've used with thousands of patients. And what I like about herbs, unlike antibiotics, is that they're really more than just about killing the bug. They really do address a lot of the other issues that Lyme creates in the body. So, you know, I always think of Lyme being kind of like if you're standing on the lake in the morning and it's a nice, quiet lake and a motorboat goes blowing by, the boat can be long gone, but you're going to see, you know, ripples in the wake that go on long after the boat's passed. And I think Lyme, to a certain degree, kind of does that to the body, too, where it creates this wake of destruction. So even after the organism's, you know, either gone, dormant, you know, at least at bay, you know, you're still left with all these other things that have happened to the body. So, you know, when I went on Chinese herbs, you know, the formulas I was taking, you know, yes, they were going after the Lyme and all these co-infections, but they were also helping reduce inflammation. They were helping improving immune circulation. They were help breaking up immune complexes. They were help boosting, you know, my own immune system. So I think it really cast a very wide net on all the different things that Lyme can do to your body. And in Chinese medicine, you know, they never use herbs singly like we do in Western medicine. They're always used as formulas, and the formulas are specifically designed to balance each other. And I really kind of felt that effect when I was taking them. And, you know, unlike antibiotics where, you know, die-off reactions tend to be very common, with herbs, I would say they're not that common at all. So, you know, if you go on the internet and you read about various herbal protocols, you know, there's 6 or 7 that come up over and over and over. And, you know, I've had people who've tried every one of them, and some people do well with one over another for no real particular reason. I think the goal of each is really very similar. And so it really is just a function of finding, you know, what works for you, what you think you can do, what fits your pocketbook. So, you know, I've got 2 protocols I've used the most in my practice, but I've certainly had plenty of other people who've used these other herbal protocols and had good clinical success.
Mm-hmm. And so, and you know, it's good to hear that about synergy, because I'm a big believer in synergy as well. And yeah, I've also noticed that not so much with Lyme, but just with generally with infections. I mean, even the labs now are culturing infections and testing them against, you know, antimicrobial agents in a petri dish. And it's interesting to see that not all infectious agents respond to the same types of antimicrobials.
Well, you know, I think we've come to a culture now where you've got a lot of antibiotic resistance.
Yeah.
So that, you know, people, you know, tend to finish or don't finish their course of antibiotics. They flush them down the toilet. Those antibiotics get into the water supply. Now that starts, you know, affecting your own normal microbes. So I'm always surprised when we actually do cultures and we see the resistance pattern for, you know, very common antibiotics. I think, you know, herbs probably, again, work in a different way. The herbs haven't been used with the same frequency that antibiotics have, and therefore resistance pattern to the herbs. I won't say it's zero because there probably is some resistance to some herbs with some people, but it certainly isn't very, very common. And again, I think by using herbs in combination, we're also helping kind of override that mechanism too.
Yeah. And so something that you've touched on a few times now is this idea of co-infections. And perhaps can you explain a little bit what exactly that is? I mean, obviously in plain English, we know what that is, but Is this extremely common? And what type of co-infections do you usually see alongside Lyme?
Yeah, so what a co-infection means is that when you get bit by a tick that carries Lyme, we know that a lot of these ticks also carry something else. You know, every time I go to a Lyme conference, it seems like that list of things that also get transmitted gets longer and longer. But some of the more common ones that we see, certainly here in the Northeast, one is called Bartonella. Bartonella is a bacteria that we mostly associate with cat scratch fever, and cats are normal carriers of Bartonella, but again, you can get it through a tick bite. There's a parasite called Babesia. Babesia is actually a cousin of malaria, so you can get cyclical fevers and get what they call air hunger, or you feel like you just can't catch a deep breath. That tends to be very common with Babesia. You can get another bacteria called Anaplasma. There's another one called Ehrlichia. You know, we even see some viruses that get transmitted. And one of the ones that made a lot of news last year was a virus called Powassan virus. And there were actually a handful of deaths in New York and Massachusetts, and maybe even one or two here in Connecticut associated with this virus, because, again, it caused a lot of damage very quickly. And by the time people figured out what was going on, it was too late. So that kind of thing is, I think, very scary in that, you know, it's harder to detect. And again, I don't think a lot of people are necessarily looking for it. But again, if you made a list of all the different possible co-infections, you know, we've probably got now about at least a dozen or more common co-infections along with Lyme. And we know up here in the Northeast that about 30 to 35% of all the ticks that carry Lyme also carry something else. So if you happen to get bit by a tick, you know, you've got at least a 30% chance of getting Lyme plus something else.
And this would require, I guess, like a nuanced approach in terms of treatment, because I would assume that some of these other infections wouldn't respond to the same agents, if you will, that the Lyme would respond to. Is that correct?
Well, not exactly. With the antibiotics, yes. You know, you definitely want to know what organism you're dealing with if you're using antibiotics. The nice thing with herbs is that most of these herbs treat all of these different infectious agents. Okay. So we do know that there are a handful of cases where we know that some herbs work better for one organism. For example, we know that Artemisia is very effective against Babesia. So if anyone comes up and they test positive for Babesia, I want to make sure that Artemisia is part of their regimen. But if they just have Lyme and nothing else, then, you know, we might use a standard protocol. So there are a few cases where certain organisms, we know that there are specific herbs that are more effective against that than even perhaps against Lyme that we would want to add into their mix.
Right. Okay, so that's good to know. That's really good to know, because I think a lot of people do, they get concerned about co-infections, they get concerned about drug and even herbal antibiotic resistance. So good to know that there is stuff you can do. So moving on to part four of your plan. So we've got gut health, we've got diet, we've got clearing up the infection. And part four?
And part four is really about, you know, minding your environment. So we know that, you know, the average person gets exposed to 80,000 chemicals a year. So it's really about taking stock of, you know, what you're putting in your hair, on your body, what kind of products you use around the house to clean, what kind of chemicals you're using in and around your lawn. You know, there's a cumulative effect of all of these, you know, potential toxins. And for some people, if they're sensitive enough, that cumulative effect can really undermine the immune system. So it's really just about kind of going through your home, going through your work environment or school environment, and trying to, you know, eliminate anything that, you know, might be bioaccumulating in your body, and, you know, replace it with something that's more natural. And I talk very specifically about mold. You know, mold is the one thing out there that probably mimics Lyme more than anything else. And if anyone's ever been lived in a water damaged building, you know, that creates the perfect environment for mold to grow. And so you can be allergic to mold, which is an immune reaction to mold spores, but you can also get what's called mycotoxicity. And some of these molds secrete a toxin that when you breathe it in can be very damaging to your nervous system and your lungs in particular. So when someone comes in, they tell me that they see, you know, black growing on their walls, or they've got a leak in their roof, you know, that's a good time to get a mold inspector in to make sure that, you know, that's not what's part of going on. So, you know, that fourth part is really about just going through your whole environment, you know, where you live, where you work, where you go to school, and just ensuring that you're taking the proper steps to make sure that, you know, you don't have that additional exposure that might be, again, undermining your immune system.
Yeah, and that's I mean, yeah, amazing, because I think that's a step that a lot of people listening have never thought of, right? You know, we're conscious of our diet, we're conscious of the medications, the supplements, whatever it is, but then we have this environmental issue going on that just keeps suppressing our immune system and keeps overloading our body. So, I do want to just ask you one question with mold. Do you feel that mold in and of itself could actually 100% mimic Lyme disease?
Pretty close to it. If you write down all the signs and symptoms of mold or mycotoxicity and Lyme, there is a tremendous amount of overlap. So
interesting.
It could be very easily confused. And I'll give you a great example. I have a patient that lives down near Washington, D.C., and she's a school teacher. And what she would tell me, I mean, is that she had a lot of symptoms consistent with Lyme. We tested her. Her test was positive. And we started, you know, going through all the steps in the treatment. And, you know, she got a little bit better. But one of the things that was very striking to her is that when she was on vacation, her symptoms were almost completely gone.
Huh.
And she would go to work, her symptoms would get worse. And on the weekend, it would get a little better. And, you know, it started making sense to me that, boy, there must be something in her school environment that that's affecting her. And then she tells me, oh yeah, you know, we've had this leak for over a year in the school, and I can see water pooling in the corner of the classroom, and kids, you know, have actually been sick quite a bit. So she actually snuck in, because the school of course didn't want to test for mold, and brought some mold plates in, and when she sent them in, her classroom was just loaded with mold. Wow. So we actually had her take several weeks off away from the environment to really give her body a break. And when she got away from the environment, it was probably a little over a week. I mean, pretty much all her symptoms were 100% gone.
Wow.
So, you know, here we were pretty sure that Lyme was a big part of what was contributing to her symptoms. And, you know, in retrospect now, we really realize that mold was probably the entire culprit the whole time. So, yes. She may have gotten bitten by a tick along the way and had antibodies against Lyme, but that wasn't really what was causing her symptoms. So unfortunately, she ended up having to leave that job because the school wasn't accommodating. But she left that job, and really she's been symptom-free since then. So I think she's a great example of, you know, how mold can really mimic Lyme.
Yeah, I mean, crazy story. Too bad the school's not going to do anything, because I really feel for the kids that have to endure that. You know, it's on their small bodies.
You know, I think when you live in an environment where there's a lot of moisture, humidity, you know, this is a very common problem in schools. And again, I've seen this, you know, even for people who don't have Lyme disease, who just have mold issues, that, you know, when they're in the moldy environment, they feel terrible. And as soon as they get away from it, they feel great. Mm-hmm. So it really is then about controlling the environment, but you know, it's always a political and financial issue with schools getting them to clean up the environment. And we had a school here in my hometown here at Fairfield, Connecticut, that had a roof that was leaking. It was going to cost $100,000 to fix the roof. The school district didn't want to pay for it, so we ended up with a $42 million new school because the mold was so bad they couldn't even fix it at that point. They had to raise the entire building down to the ground and rebuild it from scratch. So, you know, I can't understate how significant mold can be and really how damaging it can be to people's health.
Yeah, and I know you, I've heard you speak about that a lot. So, you know, and not just you, I have heard other doctors and practitioners who are also environmental medicine doctors and so on really talk a lot about mold. Yeah. So, so part five of your 5-part plan.
Yeah, so part five is really about lifestyle. And I think, you know, we tend to focus so much on the physical being of what Lyme does that we kind of ignore this other aspect, which might be tied in as much to the emotional side as the physical. So I do talk a lot about, you know, getting good quality sleep. You know, when you get that deep restorative sleep is when your body repairs and restores itself. And I see so many people that, you know, used to sleep well, and after they get Lyme, they sleep horribly. So we talk a lot about various natural methods that you can use to induce, you know, better quality sleep. And I also talk a lot about, you know, movement, body movement or exercise. And I think, you know, no matter where you are in your state, you know, there's usually something you can do to get your body moving. You know, we as humans are designed to move, and I understand what it's like when you've got joint pain and headaches. And I know when I was in the throes of Lyme, you know, exercise was certainly the last thing on my mind. But what I found is that I think it does a lot of positive things for the physical body, but certainly does a lot for your mental health. And, you know, even a little bit of movement can sometimes have a really significant impact on your mood and just how you feel about life in general. And then the last part of that's really about stress management. You know, when you're chronically sick, it's very easy to kind of wear out your spouse, your friends, your family. You know, they're all kind of tired of hearing about you not feeling well. So I think it's important that you have, you know, some support system in place, and whether it's a local support group you're involved with, or if you've got a therapist you work with one-on-one, it's really about what worked for you. But, you know, I see so many people, once they get Lyme, they start losing their friends and they become very socially isolated because they just don't feel like they want to engage other people. You know, I know when I got Lyme, I really became very disinterested in life. And I was always someone who just loved life, loved being physically active. And I became very withdrawn and kind of crawled into my shell. So I just want to encourage people that that they reach out and find that, you know, community of Lyme people out there that understand what you're going through. And at minimum, you know, find somebody locally that can help you work through some of that stuff. And, you know, and find ways to help manage stress. You know, it doesn't necessarily have to be exercise. Some people do it through art. Some people do it through music. You know, I think it's important to find those things that bring you joy in life and, you know, start to engage in those activities again.
Yeah. Well, of course, the damaging effects of stress on the immune system, on your mood, on your psyche, it's huge. And I would imagine that anyone dealing with chronic Lyme, it becomes a sort of double-edged sword, right? Where you're really just doubling down because your immune system's already weak. You're dealing with infections. You're dealing with all the other stuff. And then to have this mindset, you know, emotional, psychological drain as well, just because of the way that you feel, obviously just compounds the whole situation even further. So
yeah, it really does. It's like throwing gas on a fire. It just fuels the flames. It makes things so much worse. So, you know, I know what it's like to be stuck in that position and feeling very, you know, hopeless at some point. But again, I think that's a good opportunity to start reaching out to other people out there. And, you know, there is a very, very large community of those of us that have Lyme, have had Lyme, have dealt with it. And you've got people out there that you can reach out to. So it just takes that little bit of effort of, you know, finding those folks.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, I'm so glad that you bring all of this up because, you know, you just read so much out there that everyone is just focused solely on what's the medication, you know, what meds do I need to take, what works, and that's end of story. And so the thing that really excites me about your book, your philosophy, your approach is that it really truly is, I feel, at the root of the tenet of holistic medicine or naturopathy, which is really refreshing to hear.
Well, you know, again, having, you know, gone through Lyme myself and, you know, treated a lot of Lyme patients, you know, this was my own experience. Like I said, I went through, again, a lot of the same things that most Lyme patients go through. And, you know, for me, you know, it just wasn't working. It was actually making me sicker and sicker. So, you know, I guess I challenge people when they've been dealing with Lyme, you know, look, if you're doing any kind of therapy and it's working for you, great. You know, I'm never one to dismiss anything when it's helping you feel better. But what I see more often than not is people who've gone through, you know, one antibiotic regimen over after another. I mean, I had one patient who was on antibiotics for 12 years straight.
Wow.
And she ended up in the hospital two or three times because of her antibiotics, because of the toxic effects of it. So, you know, I guess just being logical, at what point do you draw a line in the sand and say, look, this really isn't the best way to approach it. I need to think about this differently. Mm-hmm. And it makes so much sense to me that, you know, we're all biochemically very different and we just need to find out what it is for each person that really kind of gets them over the hump. And look, it's not easy. I mean, I wish it, you know, I felt in some ways kind of silly when I was writing this book. As I kept rereading it, I'm like, boy, gosh, you just follow these steps. It just sounds so easy. And of course,
yeah.
It's never that easy. It's actually extremely difficult. And I said, you know, for me, it was, you know, 3 years of going through a bunch of stuff. And for many people, it's longer than that. So, you know, we always like to see healing be a slow, steady curve where every day is just a little bit better than the day before. And in reality, that pretty much never happens. You know, we have our good days and we have our bad days and we have our horrible days. Yeah. And it's just so frustrating. I mean, I talked with a patient of mine today who she's had Lyme for a long time, and you know, we started treatment, and initially she was doing really well. And in the last 2 weeks, she's just completely tanked and she feels worse than she did than a year ago. And, you know, she's just so frustrated, and I get it and I feel it. But I also know that it's transient and that, you know, there is light at the end of that tunnel. And when people start to get these die-off reactions and they're feeling terrible, that there is the possibility that you can also feel well. And she was feeling better. And I know it's kind of hard to remind people when they have that brief glimpse of feeling better that, you know, your body does have the capacity to heal. You know, we really do just have to, you know, find that right combination that gets you there. So, you know, it's, for me, it really is a message of hope and encouragement that, you know, if you're going down one path and you feel like you're stuck, you know, don't be afraid to shift gears and try something different.
Yeah. And, you know, I can hear when you speak, you know, you speak with so much passion. I do really feel that message of hope. And, you know, that's one of the reasons why I was so excited to speak to you, because I've personally dealt with definitely not as much as you by any means, but I've had quite a few people come through where I've suspected Lyme, and I've sort of, even as a practitioner, felt somewhat helpless, you know, where it's like, I'm not really sure what to do here. And these are people that have tried everything. They're really, really depressed. They have no hope whatsoever. So I love hearing the way that you speak. I love hearing what you're talking about and the fact that you've written this book, especially from a first person perspective, from your own experience. I think it's very empowering for other people to know that you have helped thousands of your patients, but you've also helped yourself. So you know exactly what they're going through. And that's very powerful medicine.
Yeah. Well, I said, you know, it's nothing like a little personal experience to give you a very quick education on how to deal with a problem. So, I mean, in many ways, I guess I could say I feel fortunate that this did happen to me. Because I've been able to, you know, get down at that same level and understand what everyone's gone through. Again, I've been through the psycho-emotional roller coaster, the physical roller coaster that everyone else with Lyme has gone through. So I get it. And again, you know, that's a big reason why I wrote this book. And I really want it to be a tool for people that they can walk through. And even for practitioners, you know, who are really kind of new to the Lyme game and don't really, again, quite know where to start. This is something that anyone who's a practitioner can pick up the book, educate themselves on the different therapies. You know, I actually do offer a mentorship for people who are interested in that to start really learning about how to treat Lyme. Because again, I think it's something that if you share a similar philosophy that I have, it's very easy to, you know, embrace these therapies and learn about them. And, you know, you can really just make such a big impact on people's health.
Mm-hmm. And so, you know, on that note, we'll wrap up our discussion today. But before I let you go, you know, perhaps, you know, what are you up to at the moment? I know the book just came out, so I'm sure you're inundated with interviews and tours and whatever else. But where can people find you? Where can we catch up with you and sort of keep in touch with your work?
Sure. So the best way to reach me is through my website. And my website is DarrenIngelsND.com. That's DarrenIngelsND.com. And there I've got, you know, posting of different events we do. I'm actually, you know, kicking off a book tour in the next couple of days. And I'm actually speaking at a conference in Chicago this weekend on Lyme. And then I'm actually hosting a Lyme conference on July 28th and 29th in Irvine, California. So if any practitioners really want to learn about treating Lyme in a way that I do, they can visit TheLymeConference.com, and we have all the information about that conference. It's going to be a 2-day event, and I brought in some of my colleagues who treat Lyme, again, are philosophically on the same page. So we hope to really start educating practitioners on, you know, these best ways to treat Lyme.
Amazing. And for those of you listening out there, go back to the show notes. I'm going to put all of the relevant links that Darren would like to share with us. That will all be in the show notes. So Darren, thank you once again for taking time out of your schedule. It has been a very enlightening discussion surrounding Lyme. I know that I've learned a lot. And I know that a lot of folks listening out there, whether you are a practitioner or not, I encourage you to go and pick up a copy of the book and really dive a little deeper into Lyme, because you might find that some of the chronic persistent issues that you've been dealing with, where you have not found any resolve, could actually be an underlying Lyme disease infection. So, Darren, thank you so much.
Great. Thanks, Brett.
Awesome. And for those of you listening, if you did like the show, please consider subscribing, sharing, and shooting us a message as well. If you have any questions, support@holistichealthmasterclass.com. And of course, you can also catch up with us through the website and our Facebook page. So Darren, thanks again. And to everyone out there, you have yourself an awesome day. Thank you so much.